times too seriously, because that's usually what happens to the ones that burn out early. And so, without further ado, I'd like to bring out Mr. Ian Anderson.
Hello. Sit down. Nice to see you. Hi. Do sit down. Do sit down. Thank you very much. I've got to plug in my band. I brought my band with me in the box here, and it's actually me playing all the other instruments that I play on the record, but it's cheaper than bringing out the real people, so I thought, I've got a band in the box. Let me plug it in. I have a new record out, and it's a bit of a hearkening back to the 70s, because back in those days, the band then were not really great timekeepers. They used to sometimes turn up at the studio late. And so, rather than waste time and money, because I was paying for studio time, I thought, I'll just go out there anyway and strum the guitar and do one of these little acoustic things, you know, and just get something on tape while I was waiting for them to show up. And those turned out to be the little acoustic songs you used to find on lots of the records back then, like on the Aqualung album and all the way through Songs from the Wood and stuff like that. So the thing is, the other guys, because they didn't make it in time to play on these little acoustic gems, they didn't get paid for those songs either. And I always felt very guilty about it because, you know, they enjoy playing music. So since in the last decades, I've concentrated more on writing rock music for the band, you know, something to make the drummer happy. Because let's face it, if you have to carry drums around and play them every day, you're probably not going to be happy. It's a weird and destructive thing to do for a living, beating them every night. So I try to keep the drummer happy. And so I haven't been doing that stuff for a while. I thought, let me do a record of all the little acoustic pieces, the sensitive, gentle, emotional, and personal songs that would be an album for the girls. Yeah. So this is an album, really, for all the female Jethro Tull fans, for all the girls and the guys as well who like to shave their legs and slip into something soft at the weekend and do the housework. Let's not forget them. It's called The Secret Language of Birds, the title of it, and it's based on the notion that if, like I do, you live in the country and wake every morning to the sound of birds singing outside your window, then it's a pretty good romantic ploy if you're trying to get some woman into bed to suggest that rather than be blatant about it, like Mick Jagger in Let's Spend the Night Together, or if Oasis or one of these vulgar modern British bands were to do a song of that sort, it would probably just be called Let's Shag. But I thought a more romantic and gentle, invitational idea would be better. So I suggested that if you want to have this work for you guys, just ask the lady of your intentions to spend the evening with you, drinking a little glass of wine, and then stay to wake up to the secret language of birds and singing outside a window in the morning. And I can guarantee that this works. From personal experience, it works every time. I should know. I've been married to the same woman for 24 years, and she's still there every morning when I wake up, waiting for me to make her a cup of tea. Oh, isn't that nice? So this is the title track, Secret Language of Birds.
This sparkling wine is all that empty. Too late for trains and no taxes. I know the feeling seems all too contrived. There was no master plan, but the fact is, you must stay with me and learn the secret language of birds. The deep dawn about to be breaking on a Rousseau garden with monkeys in hiding. The truth of the matter yet to be spoken. word, so much everything, everything's rhyming. Now stay with me and learn the secret language of birds. Now stay with me and learn the secret language of birds. By swallows in a world for the weary, guarded by warblers, wicked and eloquent trilling. The stillness, window cracks open, extended moments, hours for the taking, careless hair on the pillow, a bold brush stroke, painted first with a chorus in waiting. Now stay with me and learn the secret language of birds. Now stay with me and learn the secret language of birds.
It's a crow. I heard a crow. And a pheasant and a magpie too. You see, I know my birds. I don't actually know very much about birds at all, but I don't speak bird. That's why it's the secret language of birds, I just realized. So, when I go on vacation, which isn't very often because I'm not really a vacation kind of guy. My wife likes to go on vacation, and she's actually about to kill me if I don't take her on a vacation soon. So I thought I would do that. I thought I would take her to somewhere romantic, you know, somewhere warm, tropical, sultry, like South America. Maybe Venezuela seemed like a nice place. So next week I'm taking my wife for a week to Venezuela on the Caribbean coast. I think she'll like that. Apart from the fact I have some concerts to play. just something I forgot to mention. And so I have a couple of shows with the Venezuelan Symphony Orchestra, which is going to be really scary. Because the Venezuelan Symphony Orchestra speak about as much English as I speak bird. So there may be some communication difficulties. And they're going to be attempting to play some Jethro Tull songs and other stuff, conducted by David Palmer, who used to be a keyboard player with Jethro Tull back in the 70s. So we have our work cut out for us next week in Caracas. That has nothing to do with what we're going to play now, except that in a strange sense, just a few hundred miles from Caracas into the Caribbean, I have holidayed with my wife on Barbados, amongst other places, where I actually wrote some lyrics to some of these songs. And I don't know if you have the problem I do, if you're away on vacation, halfway through the week, you know, you spend the first three nights thinking, yeah, hey, I'm just here having a good time, thinking of me, relaxing. Halfway through the week, you suddenly remember the sense of immense guilt descends upon you as you remember you'd better send some postcards to the folks back home. And it's usually around the middle of the week this happens, and then you frantically rush out to buy some postcards. If you don't write them then and get them in the mail, you're going to be back before the postcards get home. So it's around Wednesday, this awful reality of having to write all the wretched postcards dawns on me. So I run out and buy all the postcards like a good chap, and then get my wife to write them all. And so this song was written about that particular
part of my week's vacation. This was originally called Postcard Wednesday and got shortened simply to Postcard Day because it sounded better in the song. And I shall attempt to play it for you.
Above cheekbones on fire, pale hand gripping my pen. Rounding up to the zero, adding infinite fractions, letting nine become ten. Two picked up, strut the shingles, picking crumbs from the breakfast I saved for you, dear. And I wish you were here on this postcard day. Focus on the fine indeterminate line where the sky meets the sea. Desperate midweek words, banal and absurd, really flow I'd be. Well, I may be a hostage to summer, but I'm a hostage, not a slave. And I'm clear that I wish you weren't here on this postcard day. Precious cargo of flotsam, mixed memories on an ocean tide. Swim madly with spice from the Orient on a mystery, watery carbon rite. With the sun going down, the wind goes around, blows them back out of mind. While a ghost of my youth, all sworn to the truth, call my name again. Two brown arms won't make the summer, two brown arms couldn't keep me away. Well, my dear, I wish you were here on this postcard day. Thank you.
I don't know what you do when you get to the fade. It's sort of a bit tricky. Postcard Day. Back in England's green and pleasant land, the farms of our country are sometimes not all they should be anymore, because we have a strange agricultural policy in Europe that means the governments pay us, farmers, to not grow anything in our fields. They actually pay us to leave the fields doing nothing except growing weeds. This is a policy called set-aside. You set aside part of your farmland to do nothing. Which is a little weird, since we understand that at any point in time a third of the planet is actually starving, but back in these rich Western countries we're being paid not to grow anything. A little odd. And very dispiriting for the farmers who actually don't utilize their land. They're unable to be custodians of the beautiful cultured green lands which should be producing something for somebody, one would have thought. So I wrote one of the shortest songs of my career about this little notion. Just a verse and a half. There's a piece called Set Aside, devoted to the sadness of the brown and empty fields. I'm beginning to feel so depressed, I wonder why I wrote this now. So. But a little depression doesn't hurt anybody, and it's blessedly quite a short song, so if you do find yourself bursting into tears halfway through, it won't be for very long. It's called Set Aside.
Deep furrows, frazzled oak, silhouetted in her ivy dress. Winter sun catches the foxtrot in hedges, throws its long shadow north to the emptiness. Farmhouse in tatters, shuttered and battered, even lovers don't go there these past few years. Spiderweb windows on set aside heroes, standing lost in a landscape of tears. Even lovers don't go there these past few years. Spiderweb windows on set aside heroes, standing lost in a landscape of tears.
Thank you. I don't know if any of you like painting. I like painting. I collect a few. I used to paint. Now I don't. I just collect the odd thing by some artists that I like. A cheap artist that I like, I should hasten to say. Mustn't spend all of Martin Barr's royalties, now must I? So there's this artist, watercolorist in England, who was actually Scottish by birth, but he became quite famous during the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, 70s, and he died in the 80s. His name was Sir William Russell Flint. And he had a penchant for painting young ladies not entirely with all of their clothes on. And in fact, he was known as an almost erotic painter. He painted these scantily clad ladies in city streets or about their ablutions, wearing not a lot. And so it seemed doubly erotic because these girls were... It was an almost voyeuristic form of art. But Willie painted... I can call him Willie now because he's dead. Sir William painted from life using models, most of the same one. And all of his long career, he specialized in very pretty younger models. And every time they would come to start work in the studio, Sir William used to never answer the door until he had put on his suit jacket, done up his collar and straightened his tie. And he was always a complete and perfect gentleman at all times throughout this work. And he was indecently, almost in a Victorian, really super conservative way, he was such an old-fashioned gentleman. And it was only literally on his deathbed that he wrote a letter to his favorite model, in which he poured from the heart the fact that for all the years that he'd been painting her naked or semi-clad, that he'd actually had a stiffy.
He'd had the hots for his models all the way along, but he was far too perfect a gentleman to have ever revealed that. And I thought this was really sad that he died never having had carnal knowledge of any of these voluptuous creatures. And poor Sir William doubtless was quite a frustrated chap. In fact, just talking about it now makes me a little frustrated too, so I should get on with it. This one is actually about one of his paintings called The Little Flower Girl. And it just talks about whether or not it might have been a good idea after all. Just once, maybe, to have struck up a more dangerous liaison. The Little Flower Girl.
At the church, the flower girl sits, legs and her sons apart. I make the picture puzzle fit in the start, your heart. Painted sister, stop aside, word upon her saintly lip. Perhaps admonishing the child in spite, the open slip. Well, I don't know where she might go when she runs home at night. It's for the best, I wouldn't rest when I turn out the light. No little flower girl, sing me in my troubled dream. Just an old man's bottle in a pose from a magazine. Brushed that face a dozen times before, and I have let my pants run. Laid down while she's on a foreign shore, under a hot and foreign sun. A bare sable breast she's stripped, the soft inside of her arm. Her skin I tilled, her breast I lipped, I mean no harm. Close the door, she is no more, until the next appointed hour. Northeastern lights push back the night, painted promises in store. No little flower girl singing in my troubled dream. Just an old man's model in a pose from a magazine. Sits, legs in a sand apart. To make a picture puzzle fit in the start, your heart. A bare sable brush is stripped, the soft inside of her arm. Her chin I tilt, her breast I lift. I mean no harm. I mean no harm.
Thanks, that was a little flower girl.
San Diego Sets 102. Hi, this is Madison, and I was hosting this particular Sets 102 Loyal Listener event with Jethro Tull's lead vocalist Ian Anderson on a lovely Sunday afternoon at the Reuben H. Fleet Science Center when Ian played tracks from his new album, The Secret Language of Birds, for a party of about 85 Sets 102 Loyal Listeners, which you are all taking part in tonight. And by the way, it's a great album. If you've been listening, stay with us. There's more to come. And if you've just joined us...
Spicy foods. Yes, you do. Good. Good. Well, I do too. It's probably because of being brought up in the UK where we have about 10,000 Indian restaurants, and roast beef and Yorkshire pudding and such fallacies are now swept away in favor of the of the chicken tikka masala and other objects of Indian culinary delight, which the Brits actually now go and consume on average once a week. A typical British family eats at least one Indian meal every week. So it's the new cuisine of England, really. But they don't have over there the gorgeous Central American minor miracle, the habanero chili, rates number 10 out of 10 on the Richter scale of having to visit the toilet rather too often. And the habanero is so hot that even if you just pluck one off the habanero bush... I don't laugh. All right, then there's some botanical person up there. It's actually Capsicum frutescens. So there. That's the Latin name for the habanero. The English term is just f***ing hot. It's a very, very hot, a very hot chili pepper. I mean, if you handle it with, you know, handle it with bare hands, taking it off the bush, then you really have to remember to wash your hands very quickly before, by accident, you might touch any other part of your anatomy or that of your partner. It has been the case in my household that several of us have gone leaping into the shower at around about the same time. And the habanero is a dangerous beast. So in ode of the habanero, which promotes that rush of endorphins, so hot, the capsaicin, the chemical in the hot chili peppers, it gives you this endorphin rush. And it's probably like taking drugs or something, except, as the song says, best of all, it's strictly legal. You actually can't get arrested yet for being in possession of a habanero chili pepper. Yet. So set to an Irish feel, this is the habanero reel.
Tomcat sitting on the edge of the yard, sandflies flitting. Orange ardor in a field of green smothers me to smithereens. Rum and cola, ice cubes crashing, jumping beans, brown eyes flashing. Draw their swing and tell me how you feel. Well, often fancy is the happier. Skin, pour oil upon it. But she's fed to burn in her new Scotch bonnet. Spice up anybody's stew. Frogs and goats and chickens too. Rum and cola, ice cubes crashing, dropping beans, brown eyes flashing. Draw their swing and tell me how you feel. Well, barefoot in the sunshine, keg and empty beer cans down on a high time line. Big wave nearly blows your dress away, and I'm thinking that it's just another day, just another day. Feel that hot rush start, it's tickling. Sweat is rising, taste buds prickle. With ears of bat and eye of eagle, it's just as well as strictly legal. Rum and cola, ice cubes crashing, jumping beans, brown eyes flashing. Long hair swinging, tell me how you feel. Well, hot and fancy, it's the happier feel. Barefoot in the sunshine, keg and empty beer cans down on the high tide line. Big wave nearly blows your dress away, but I'm thinking that it's just another day, just another day.
Very good, thank
now
you.
Now that Boris Yeltsin has gone, I mean, I miss Boris because Boris was a man you could trust. Boris you could do business with. Because Boris, by middle of the day, had drunk at least 3 bottles of vodka and didn't know what day it was. So this was a guy who could not find the nuclear button to press to blow us all to kingdom come. So you were safe with Boris. I'm not so sure that we're safe with Mr. Putin. Because Mr. Putin, by all the evidence so far, is a man who likes a good war and seems to revel in it. And so he's kind of a worrying figure. I'm not sure if I write a piece of music dedicated to Vlad. But, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt. But this is one that's dedicated to Boris because of his antics in Red Square when he was seeking re-election a few years ago. He was boogieing frantically on stage in Red Square in front of a young Moscow band and was caught by the world's cameras, most notably CNN, which is what I watch. And Boris was an enthusiastic but somewhat uncoordinated and completely mindlessly drunk dancer. And to celebrate Boris's 2 left feet, I thought I would write a piece of music dedicated to Boris, which is in colliding time signatures. And it's just meant to be suggestive of Boris's boogie. And so with great fondness, we'll miss old Boris, won't we? This is called Boris Dancing. That's Boris Dancing. While I'm standing up here, anybody have any questions they'd like to ask me about anything?
I've seen you live one other time, and that was at the Avalon Ballroom in San Francisco quite a while ago. And really was impressed with the music and so forth, and also with the way you stood.
What, about 1969?
Yes, correct.
Don't tell me. No, wait. You were about three rows back, slightly to my left, completely comatose, and
I wasn't comatose, but you're
out of your brain.
You have this section correct, yes. Okay. But I used to stand like that, and I thought, gosh, you know, he's comfortable standing like that too, and it just kind of intrigued me how you could stay balanced and play and, you know, all that with standing on one leg. So I was just wondering.
It began, I believe, at the Marquee Club in London, because I was a harmonica player. I mean, I started off when I was trying to learn to play the flute. I started also trying to play the harmonica. And when I used to play the harmonica, for some reason, I used to go, you know, I don't know, it was the height. Because, you know, you have to suck. People don't think you blow into harmonicas. You actually only blow a little bit most of the time. Sucking. It's ridiculous. And when you... if you wear underpants as tight as I used to when I was 20 years old, the high notes used to... You know, this leg used to come up. So people would write about it, you know, the first... ever reviews of the early Jethro Tull mentioned me standing on one leg. They also mentioned that I was playing the flute or trying to. And they put the two things together, said that I played the flute standing on one leg. So I read this in the papers and thought, well, you know, hey, an image is an image. let's go with it, you know. Hey, so... And so this whole thing kind of stuck with me standing on one leg playing the flute. So I did it, you know, dutifully to begin with. But it was kind of fun. And I think the thing about it probably is psychologically, you know, if you're playing, then there is this sense of balance that comes from, you know, this posture, which is sort of this out here and this over here. And it does, in fact, have a strange kind of sense of balance. And when you're playing, concentrating on a piece of music, it's psychologically, I think it's quite helpful, that sense of stillness, of balance, of it seems to work. And I did this for years and years and years, and it was only when, in fact, on the same trip to India in about 1991 or something, that I did a press conference in a hotel in Bombay, right next to the Air India building that had just been blown up the day before, killing thousands. I mean, it was horrendous. I mean, I arrived the day after this enormous bomb blast, and looking out of my bedroom window, there was just this wreck of a building, you know, with I think 1,000 or 2,000 people got killed. It was just horrendous. I was there the next day and I thought, this has blown it now, because no way. I mean, in the wake of this awful disaster, are anybody going to care about the fact that I'm there, you know, in terms of the radio or press or TV or whatever? But they did actually all turn up. And everything was high security, police and army everywhere, and the press, to give them their due, all arrived at this hotel, which was apparently on the hit list, you know, to be blown up, along with the airport in Bombay. And I thought it was incredibly brave of all the media in Bombay to come to this press conference. And I realized it was incredibly brave of me too. Incredibly stupid of me to be there, in fact. But we did this press conference, and the first thing they did was to say, why are you making a joke? Why are you mocking our most important, or one of our most important Hindu gods, Krishna? And I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand what you mean. And they said, well, you know, the standing on one leg thing, that's Krishna does that, the Indian god, flute-playing god Krishna. And I didn't at the time know too much about Hinduism, so I didn't realize that he did, in fact, I'm sorry, he is depicted in most art forms or in sculpture, he is depicted standing, not like this, but kind of like that. But it's definitely, he's doing the one-legged flute-playing thing. And I thought, damn, you know, someone got there before me. And... So I furtively sort of, you know, oh, I'm sorry about this, but, you know, I didn't realize, I didn't know anything about Krishna. I just started doing it, obviously, I'm terribly sorry, you know, I won't ever do it again, promise. And so they forgave me. And then when I was a couple of years later in Bolivia, some folks gave me a charm, a little silver amulet. And it was of a god, an Andean god of the Indians. And he too stands on one leg and plays the flute. And this is thousands of miles away from Hinduism and the Krishna thing. And I thought, this is really strange. Now this makes three of us. If this keeps up, we'll have the X-File people here, you know? Something weird is going on. strange, isn't it? What was the question? Yes, about standing on one leg. Yeah, so it's one of those things that I, you know, I'd be kind of embarrassed to do it here because you're all so close. And jokingly, in fact, the next Jethro Tull tour, which begins on the 6th of June in Austin, Texas, and wends its way across this part of the country. No, in fact, it doesn't. It wends to the east, to the north, and then back to the west. I think we're coming up here somewhere around about early part of September. But it's actually known as, because we just did the artwork for the print ads, it's actually called the A Leg to Stand On tour. And it just, it's a silhouette of the old me. You know, the skinny guy with the long hair. Is I playing the flute? It's the old me in silhouette. But, and I thought that's what it's going to be called, A Leg to Stand On. There you go. And I'm just going to do one more piece before I say goodbye to you all. And thanks very much for coming and listening to me. And I hope you enjoy the new Ian Anderson solo album, The Secret Language of Birds. If you should get round to buying it, that would be nice. And if you don't, then just borrow it from a friend. If it's not a friend, then just don't give it back. You know, it's... I'm going to play one more thing, which is a very obvious thing, but it's an interesting diversion for me, because this is actually the original Jethro Tull band of the early 70s, and I had reason to go back and listen to this original mix, I mean the original master tape, multi-track tape, so I decided it would be great to hear old Jeffrey Hammond playing the bass, and Clive Bunker on the drums, and John Evans on piano, and the early plump... Martin Barr. He's now a skinny guy who runs 10 miles every day, which just really pisses me off. But back then he used to be a tubby little chap, and so this is the tubby little Martin Barr doing the original version of this song with me doing my bit on top. And then I suddenly realized that Andrew Giddings would be very upset because we had to play this on a German TV show where they won't let you actually play live in Germany for some reason. You always have to mime, you know, do playback. So they might let me sing live, but the band will have to be on tape because they just can't be bothered to set up all the microphones and do that stuff in Europe. So we had to switch John Evans for Andy. So this is Andy playing with Jeffrey Hammond, which is quite interesting. You can do these things in the world of record making, but it's interesting taking the old stuff and putting a couple of new guys on it. And oh, what the hell. You'll recognize the piano intro. Thanks again for coming. I'm going to run away at the end of this because I've got to go and do this thing in Portland. So.